Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about the impact of climate change on the Colorado ski industry. A new report shows that future ski seasons will be significantly reduced, impacting the economy and the possibility of the loss of thousands of jobs. Then, as we have been looking at zero waste issues in the past year, we'll hear how some young activists in Telluride on Colorado's western slope are working to eliminate plastic waste in their schools. They're influenced and inspired by a group of young activists right here in Boulder. We'll have the latest news in cannabis with Leland Rucker taking a look at some possible legislation here in Colorado in the new 2019 session that will impact the cannabis industry. Then John Lendorf will be in live in the studio for Radio Nibbles. After headlines from the BBC, we'll rebroadcast an interview that we aired several months ago with local author Heather Hansen, who has written about the impact of wildfire here in Colorado. And at 9 o'clock, it is Destination Freedom with our own Donny Betts. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Hannah Lee Myers.
Wednesday, the Associated Press obtained an email from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service instructing federal workers to return to their posts at dozens of wildlife refuges despite the government shutdown. In the email, the principal deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Service explained the partial restaffing of 38 wildlife refuges, saying opportunities including hunting are being lost in the shutdown, impacting both their ability to serve the public and to protect natural resources under their care. The agency says they plan to bring back some furloughed staff using carryover funds. Breaking from the norm, the Interior Department's decision to keep national parks open with minimal staffing during this government shutdown has led to overflows of garbage and human waste in parks. Also on Wednesday, multiple major environmental groups urged the Trump administration to keep national parks, wildlife refuges, and other public lands closed during the shutdown to protect the area from pollution. Those environmental groups added that keeping the parks open with too few employees is a ploy to make the shutdown less painful to the American public, all the while putting wildlife at risk. Over the weekend, the National Park Service said some parks could start using visitor fees to staff their employees during the shutdown. AstraZeneca has announced it will be closing its Longmont and Boulder facilities. With more, here's Rod Brewski.
The biologics manufacturing firm announced it will be shuttering its Longmont and Boulder production facilities, laying off 210 workers in March. The Daily Camera reports that back in 2017, Darren Doshberg, the site director of AstraZeneca, told the Boulder Economic Council about the importance of Boulder for his business. He was quoted of saying, "We received thousands of quality resumes for 250 jobs in Boulder. We'll eventually have another 400 to 500 jobs in Longmont." With this change of direction, executive director of Boulder Economic Council said the closure is unfortunate and he is concerned about the impact on the employees. For KGNU, I'm Rod Brewski.
Today, Jared Polis will give his first State of the State address as Colorado governor. And according to an interview published by the Colorado Sun Wednesday, he plans to pursue a bold new legislative agenda and submit executive orders right away. Polis says his administration is prepared to push aggressively on a number of issues, including education, health care, and corporate tax breaks, right from the start, leveraging the Democratic majority in the General Assembly. Wednesday, Polis announced four new appointees to his cabinet, including Dan Gibbs, currently a Summit County Commissioner as Executive Director of the Department of Natural Resources, and Jill Hunsaker Ryan as Executive Director of the Department of Public Health and Environment. For more on the legislative agenda Polis plans to roll out this week, tune in to Metro this afternoon at 3 o'clock and the Morning Magazine tomorrow at 8. Expect a high today somewhere around 57 degrees, low tonight somewhere around 29. We do see a chance for snow starting today and lasting into tomorrow night, with a high tomorrow of only 36 degrees. It's currently around 38 degrees on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Hannah Lee Myers.
It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. A recent study found that a changing climate could cut the length of the ski season in half in some parts of the US by 2050 and by even more by the end of the century. This could have significant impacts on Colorado's ski industry, which generates almost $5 billion annually and creates more than 46,000 jobs. KDNK's Amy Hayden Marsh takes a look now at two resorts on Colorado's western slope to find out what they're doing to protect the snow and the bottom line as part of our ongoing water series, Connecting the Drops.
Sunlight Mountain Resort near Glenwood Springs opened early this year on November 23rd. 2017 was a different story. Opening day was December 21st, the latest start of ski season at Sunlight since 1985. 2017 was also the third driest year on record in Colorado, and snowpack statewide was the lowest in three decades. At Sunlight, natural snowfall was down by half that year, and it was too warm to make much snow. Visits were down 25%. Sunlight is a small resort with 680 acres of skiable terrain and $1 million annual budget. It caters mostly to locals, with an average of 80,000 to 100,000 skier visits per year. Troy Hawks, Sunlight's marketing director, says 2017 was interesting, but not the first time the state has had a dry winter.
When we talked to the old timers of this valley, they said the last time they saw a snow year like last year was in 78-79 season, as I understand it.
He added that the year before, which would have been the 2016-2017 season, was a record year for Sunlight. But Colorado winters have become variable enough for Sunlight to take precautionary measures, such as purchasing new, more efficient snowmaking guns and building two new snowmaking ponds. Cameron Wobus, a senior scientist at Linker Technologies, a water and environmental resources consultant group in Boulder, says that's one thing ski resorts need to be doing, adapting to climate change.
What ski resorts can do is they can make their snowmaking more efficient. One adaptation that is being implemented in various places around the world is downloading. So basically having a gondola that can get people to the middle of the mountain where there might be more snow, and then you just ski the top half of the mountain.
Wobus worked on a 2017 study about projected climate change impacts on skiing and snowmobiling in the U.S. He said the goal of the study was to understand the difference between what happens if we start mitigating carbon emissions and what happens if we don't.
The higher resorts, Arapahoe Basin is the one that sticks out because it's the highest resort in the state of Colorado, might have reductions, 10 to 20% change in season length under the worst scenario. Some of the lower resorts have much more significant changes in season length.
But ski resorts statewide are already experiencing fewer visitors, particularly in the early part of ski season. The 23 resorts that are members of the trade group Colorado Ski Country USA reported an average of 8% fewer skier visits in December 2016 than the previous season. December 2017 visits were 13% down from that. Vail Resorts reported a 13% decline in skier visits for December 2016 and an additional 11% decline in 2017. Skiing as a sport has a small carbon footprint, but Wobus says the industry could suffer significant impacts from shorter winters and needs to take more of a stand against climate change.
What some ski resorts have been doing, particularly Aspen, I'll point out, are using their customer base and their position in the industry to really take a leadership role in getting people to think about climate change.
This isn't really about your carbon footprint or mine. We now know that we have a global problem, and we have to respond to it at global scale.
Auden Schendler runs the sustainability program for Aspen Skiing Company and sits on the Basalt Town Council.
So you could argue the big, powerful organizations who have access to wealth and influence are the exact organizations that ought to be pushing hard on climate. And that's what we're doing.
With 5,000 acres of skiable terrain, 1.4 million annual skier visits, and 4,000 employees, Aspen Ski Co., as it's known locally, is considerably larger than Sunlight Mountain Resort. Schindler said that in the face of a changing climate, Aspen Ski Co. has improved infrastructure and expanded geographically by offering the Icon Ski Pass, which includes other resorts.
But to me, that's just business. The issue is, how do we reduce the impact of this problem for everybody so that maybe you retain some level of skiing down the line, but more importantly, that you do what you have the power to do as a ski resort, which is maybe influence a social movement and reduce the damage.
Schindler adds that Aspen Ski Co. has been involved with state environmental and energy policy issues for over a decade. Back at Sunlight, Troy Hawks says their climate policy focuses on conservation, education, and maintaining a small footprint.
We are not overbuilt. We are not a mega resort. We've got three small chairlifts. We've got a small bed and breakfast that has about 19 rooms, and that really sums up the size of our resort.
Aspen Ski Co.'s resources allow the company to take bigger steps than smaller ski areas, but Schindler says it's too late to compare the actions of larger resorts to those of small resorts.
We have 10 years to essentially rewire the global economy so that it's carbon free. So the question of the day should not be, hey, you're big, that one's small, their carbon footprint's less. The question is, what's the biggest leverage you have access to, and are you using it to drive change?
Despite his study's warning, ski industry consultant Cameron Wobus says skiing is not going away.
Depending on where you are, ski resorts might be starting to see really short ski seasons if we don't do anything to mitigate carbon emissions. But skiing is not over. There will always be places where you can get high enough to find snow. And fortunately for those of us in Colorado, many of those places are in our state.
For Connecting the Drops, I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
Well, for the past 12 months, KGNU has been partnering with EcoCycle, taking a look at zero waste issues. And we're going to culminate the year-long series with a community conversation happening on Thursday, January 31st at the Longmont Museum on the impact of plastic waste in our environment and some of the challenges, but also opportunities on reducing plastic waste. Well, as part of this series now, we're going to turn back to the Western Slope and take a look at a local student activist group in Telluride. They're leading the change in their community by making the switch from plastic cutlery to silverware in the cafeteria. And they're hoping other schools will follow suit. And they've been inspired by the Earth Guardians, a movement located right here in Boulder. KOTO's Amy Peters has the story.
Every week, thousands of tossed plastic spoons and forks from cafeterias and restaurants across town head to regional landfills. Last year, a young activist, Forrest Olson, spearheaded an initiative to get the Telluride Elementary School to stop using single-use plastics and switch to reusable metal cutlery instead. Forrest Olson's father is Ken Olson, who, as director of operations and technology for the school district, was also involved in the transition.
I really loved what Forrest did, so we helped him craft a letter to his principal and put together procedures, and he just did an incredible job. And he was on CODA last year, and as he said, well, first the elementary school, then the big school, and then the whole wide world.
Since then, community members have wondered why the same transition hasn't been in place at the Telluride Intermediate High School. As a member of the Carbon Neutral Coalition, a think tank that brainstorms ways to alleviate the carbon footprint in our region, Joanna Canow also helped with the transition.
The school was using silverware, and somewhere along the line, too many of the forks and spoons were tossed out in the garbage, so they had to go to plastic in order to feed the children because they had run out of the silverware. And so this looked like something that could be easily remedied if we got the community behind us.
Canow pointed out that the switch to metal cutlery in the public school cafeterias has occurred ahead of implementation of ordinances passed in both the Mountain Village and the town of Telluride that will ban the use of single-use plastics across the local food service industry. The switch to silverware in the intermediate upper school was accomplished this fall over a month-long push by numerous interested parties.
we can, and then the Earth Guardian group and Ken from the school and parents and school board and many people who are, you know, helping, wanting to get on board made this happen so swiftly, and now the transition has happened.
Kanau noted one caveat necessary to implementing the change.
Ken said, I think we can get this done, but it needs to come from the kids.
Instrumental in the school-wide silverware drive were students in the fifth grade, particularly a group of young environmental activists called the Earth Guardians, an after-school group run by parent Stacy Tixi, who follow a national curriculum created for student activists. Throughout the year, Earth Guardians educate themselves about the environment, host bake sales, make posters and produce public service announcements around environmental issues, and water and harvest plant life in the Grow Dome, a greenhouse located behind the high school. Two fifth graders, Chase Wesson and Marilyn Jones, were at the forefront of the cutlery initiative, encouraging students to collect cutlery from home and from friends so that the majority of the cutlery was donated, not purchased.
Well, we had to start collecting silverware that we could donate to the cafeteria. We had to start, like, telling people in our grade and everybody else, all the other grades, that what they can do to help.
We started a contest, whatever class earned the most silverware, won a pizza party. So that's what helped us raise a lot of silverware for our cafeteria.
In an effort to motivate cutlery donations, the Carbon Neutral Coalition sponsored a pizza party for the class who collected the most cutlery. While Wesson and Jones were successful in collecting cutlery, their fifth grade class were not the winners.
Miss Wolf's class in the fifth grade.
Are either of you in Miss Wolf's class?
No.
No pizza for you guys.
Kanau surmised that this switch to metal cutlery is an effective example of doing and not just talking about doing. According to Olson, the resulting 400-plus units of metal cutlery were acquired in a cost-neutral way. The Carbon Neutral Coalition helped to underwrite a new industrial washing rack for the cutlery, as well as helping to purchase a magneted garbage bin to capture silverware that is accidentally tossed, a behavior that the Earth Guardians hope to change. For Western Slope Resources Reporting, I'm Amy Peters.
And once again, you can join us for a community conversation on reducing plastic waste in our community. That's going to be happening on Thursday, January 31st at 6:30 p.m. at the Longmont Museum. And that will be the culmination of our year-long series, taking a look at zero waste issues in collaboration with EcoCycle. Leland Rucker is the senior editor at Sensi Magazine, and he joins us on Thursday mornings to talk about the latest news in cannabis. Today, with just under a week of the 2019 state legislative session under our belt, we're going to take a look at some bills that have already been introduced and really what lies ahead at the state legislature when it comes to cannabis and also hemp.
Yeah, you know, the Colorado General Assembly began its four-month term on January 4th. That was last Friday. And I think cannabis is going to play a pretty big role in the issues this year that the legislators will be facing. And with the democratically controlled both houses and the governor, I think that's another reason why we can expect a lot of that. There's already been two bills already introduced. This is not surprising at all. One would allow the autism to be added to the list of conditions that physicians could recommend cannabis for. Last year, that one was passed by both houses by a high number and was vetoed by the governor. And the current governor, Jared Polis, has said that he will pass that. He will go ahead and sign that. So that's pretty much a given. Another one will be about opioids and about using cannabis to wean people from opioids. It would give them people a better chance of doing that. And I think that one's probably going to pass as well, even though the health department and people have some questions about that. But I think those are two that are definitely going to happen. Another one is consumption. You know, we've talked about this over the years many, many times. Last year, there was a consumption bill that would have allowed tasting rooms in dispensaries, and I think we can expect something like that again, probably a little bit more expansive than that one. That one was very limited to try to get the governor to sign it. It wasn't enough, obviously. I'm sure that that's going to happen. There's another lobbying a group of lobbyists who are trying to push for having two licenses. And this would be this is a very interesting thought. One would be for businesses that don't want to sell the product. They don't want to be involved in that. They just want to allow people to use it on the premises, like hotels, coffee shops, yoga studios. So that would be one license. And you could get a license for one event, or you could get a permanent license. The other one would be a license that would allow you to sell cannabis on premises as well as use it, which is similar to the tasting bill. And the third thing about that one is that they want the alcohol industry to be able to participate as well. And this is going to definitely come up with some opposition, but their argument, and I think it's a good argument, is that the alcohol industry knows how to deal with overconsumption, with people who aren't ready to drive, people who, you know, they really know this, and so maybe, and they're against the cannabis industry right now because they're not involved in it, and it's by rule that they're not involved. So I think that's going to happen. I think that delivery is going to come back up again. Canada has used the mail for its medical marijuana program over the last decade, and it's worked just fine. There seems to be a lot of opposition to it because law enforcement says that couriers would become targets, but I would think that it's better to have couriers out there bringing it to people rather than people driving to get it, because that's one of the things that law enforcement is worried about as well.
People possibly driving while impaired.
Correct, exactly. And so I think that that's going to be one. There's probably going to be a big battle. The other main thing is that all of the codes for medical marijuana and for recreational marijuana are up for changes. There's a sunset clause at the end of 5 years, and that's going to end in September, so the legislature is going to have to either amend those, leave them as they are, or make changes. And I think we're going to definitely see some changes there.
What do you mean the codes?
The codes that govern how you process, how you grow, how you process, and how you sell. They're different for medical marijuana than they are for recreational marijuana. And one of the things they want to do is streamline the licensing and the ownership rules, allow dispensaries to sell hemp products, require testing of CBD products that are similar to THC products, and unify some of the rules about cultivating retail and medical cannabis. They're different right now. And I think we can expect that to happen, that there will be some, at least minor changes, maybe some major changes if somebody has that idea.
Well, people can read more about those bills that have been introduced and ones that potentially will be coming up in the upcoming four-month legislative session online at ncmag.com. And Leland Drucker joins us Thursday mornings. Thanks, Leland.
Thank you.
Time now for Radio Nibbles.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy.
Everybody eats on Thursday mornings because that's time for Radio Nibbles when John Lendorf joins us to share the latest food news. Good morning.
Good morning, Maeve.
It is that time of year.
Yes, surprisingly, actually. It's time for oatmeal. I was there 23 years ago when the... When Lafayette decided to have an oatmeal festival. It was a quaint, cool idea and a fit one, you know?
Well, we have been covering this in the news. Who knew oatmeal could be so controversial? But this has generated some news coverage because it was off again, then it was on again, then it was off again, but now it is back on again, Lafayette's Oatmeal Festival.
Yes, the corporate powers, basically Quaker Oats, for whom this event was invented, decided willy-nilly, well, we don't want to do that anymore. And they just abandoned it. And there was an outcry from oatmeal enthusiasts, of which apparently Maeve is not one.
Not a huge fan, I have to say. I grew up eating porridge, or more accurately, being force-fed porridge for most of my childhood. And so I'm not a huge fan of oatmeal.
You didn't say, please, sir, can I have some more?
Well, I did, and I got more. Well, actually, I think I said, please, mom, can I stop eating this? But anyway, my wishes were not granted. Yeah. But the Oatmeal Festival is back on. This is the 23rd one now.
And, of course, the biggest part of it is this oatmeal breakfast, where you walk in, you get a bowl, they give you some oatmeal, and then there's 128 toppings. And it's all sweet, you know, and generally Americans do sweet things to grains and breakfast cereal. And, you know, in the rest of the world, that isn't the case. And I think what Lafayette needs is a oatmeal dinner. There are great hot grain dishes across the world that are wonderful, but they're savory. Things like grits and shrimp, creamy polenta, couscous, risotto, and one of my favorites, congee, which is a rice porridge from Asia that has fish and meat and vegetables in it. So I think there should be a savory breakfast. One of my favorites is you make oatmeal, leave out the sweet stuff, add some grated cheese to it. I don't like it goopy. I like it, you know, chewy. And then you put eggs and bacon on top.
Yum. Well, maybe that will be on offer. People can go and check out the Oatmeal Festival. It's happening in Lafayette. It's this Saturday, right?
At Pioneer Elementary School.
All the oatmeal your hearts desire. But there's a lot of other local food news as well, including the upcoming 15th Boulder International Film Festival. Is that the Food Film Festival or just the regular film festival?
That's the regular film festival, but they have a very cool event. It's, by the way, February 28th to March 3rd. I bring it up now because tickets are going quickly for the Cine Chef competition. It's very cool this year. There's two teams, one from Denver, one from Boulder, and it's all women chefs. So it includes people like Sheila Lucero from Jax and Jennifer Jasinski from Rioja.
Well, aside from oatmeal, what's the best thing you've tasted lately?
Maeve, it's what I'm drinking right now. So what I do is I take fresh ginger, I slice it very thinly, I put it in a bottle. I add some wedges of lime or lemon, usually ones that are seconds. And then I add some green tea and put in some tart cherry juice, and it's anti-inflammatory. And
Does that beverage have a name? The Nibble Special.
There you go.
Renaming it here. Well, you can read John's column about Rocky Mountain oysters in the January issue of Sensi magazine. And, of course, catch archived Radio Nibbles at news.kgnu.org.
Bon appetit.